The Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Public Safety Subcommittee, for Wednesday, May 4th, 2005. We are in a public hearing on House Bill 5057, the Oregon State Police. We're going to continue with the agency presentation and then after that move into some public testimony. If you are here to testify on the Oregon State Police budget, there is a sign-up sheet on the table near the wall. Please be sure to get your name on that. The second part of our agenda, should there be time, will be devoted to continuing the agency presentation with the Office of Homeland Security. And again, that's time permitting. And so with that said, we are beginning without a quorum, and we have Support Services Bureau up this morning, or this afternoon. It is afternoon. Everything's starting to blend. Major Pete Spirup and David Schmierbach, please tell us where you would like us to go in the notebook, and we'll continue our presentation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peter Spirup. I'm a major in Command and Support Services Bureau, and here with me at the table is David Schmierbach, who is the director of the Forensic Services Division. We would direct you to the tab that's marked Forensic Services Division, page 1. And with that, I'll let Mr. Schmierbach get started.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Schmierbach. I'm the director of the Forensic Services Division of the Oregon State Police. We're going to move through this quickly. As you may know, the Forensic Services Division is a sole source provider of forensic services. We are the only full-service forensics delivery system in the state of Oregon. We only do approximately 11% of the work for our own agency, the Oregon State Police. The rest is for the chiefs, the sheriffs, and other members of the criminal justice community. In 2002, we received approximately 34,000 requests for services. In 2004, that's been reduced to 21,000 due to a heavy triage and prioritization guidelines. Those have been provided to you in the agency's question and answer packet that we've previously discussed with you. Historically, where we've been, before I can talk to you about where we are today, prior to the layoff in 2003, we had 120 FTEs assigned to the forensics work in the division, 135 total. The difference between the two, 15 were assigned to the evidence lockers for the patrol offices. So we started at 120 in January of 2003. February 1, we laid off 85. We went to 50. In March 5th, we were authorized to return to 90. At the end of the 2003 legislative session, we were authorized to return to 107. We have been struggling through hiring and retention problems to return to 107. The highest we've been able to get to is 105. In the last 10 days, I've received two resignations and noticed that two more are coming in the next 2 months. So by the end of this biennium, we'll be in the 101-102 staff level. The governor's rec for 2005-2007 is at 108. The best I can say for what we're doing right now with the current staffing levels and our submission rates is we have a heavy triage system to match the amount of work coming into the lab system for what we're capable of putting out. Like I gave you numbers just a minute ago, our submissions are about two-thirds of what they were 2 years ago. The governor's recommended budget for 05-07 has a few holes in it. I'd like to bring your attention to page 3. The first significant shortfall occurs in the supplies and services area. This is a result of when we did the layoffs and rehires. although it's hard to follow exactly what happened, the best I can describe to you is I think the supplies and services and capital outlay were not added back when we added back from 50 to 90, and that created a shortfall in the supplies and services area. That's currently at $600,000for the 2005-07 biennium. Also, approximately $297,000 of capital outlay. Historically, we've been running in the range of $1.1 to $1.2 million in capital outlay a biennium to stay current with all of our scientific instrumentation. Last biennium, we were authorized $297,000. The absolute minimum I think we can get by with is about half of what we were getting by with, and that's by extending the life of our instruments even further than they currently are, some of which are quite old. The third impact that I think exists is in the implementation of the new intoxilizer program. First, I'd like to correct an error in the document before you. There shows $1.7 million in COP monies to replace. That should be $1.556 million. There's an error there. What was not funded was approximately $197,000 in supplies and services to implement that program. These would be training aids, room and board while the teams go around the state and install the instruments and train every user. That's every police officer in the state, every district attorney, and every DMV hearings officer would have to be retrained on the new instrumentation. So the three put the 0507 budget approximately $1.2 million short. I have two options at this time, is to freeze those vacancies that I was just describing that we have for the biennium to make up that shortfall, or we could come back during an e-board appearance as the biennium unfolds and seek additional monies at that time. Basically, in a short presentation, the rest of it's there for your reading, that's the status of your Forensic Services Division for 0507, and I'd be more than willing to take questions at this time.
Thank you, sir. Questions or comments? Mr. Wilson, did you wish to speak to the shortage?
Madam Chair, the shortages do occur. I'm not sure. I'd have to look back on the history. I'm aware of them.
Okay.
Part of them are, this is not the only division that has shortages in it. I think you heard the Information Management Division, because of how certain things are done in the governor's budget, has some significant shortages also, along with the continuing problem of the ID or identification services, criminal background checks. So this budget during work session will need a lot of work to get things straightened out and moved around. And the question will be, where will the money come from?
Right.
What was, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Wilson, what would, we were told it's down to 105 and it may go to 103, so that's... five positions, 100 and what were we told, 180,000, or what's the position?
In forensics, I don't know. The position of, I think, 180 or whatever I told you, 1,000 before, was for a trooper on the road, meaning a patrol trooper.
Car and everything.
We would have to check. The forensics people, it depends on what positions. You have scientists, you have technicians, you have support staff, so it varies on what position is vacant. We could work something up if you wish to see that.
I hope we'd find the money.
Additional information?
Nothing more, Madam Chairman, other than to say whatever the budget is for this division, we'll do the best job we can for you with the funds provided.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate your presentation and your service. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes,
I think, as members of the legislative body, thank you for doing the best you could during that time. That's not a fair thing to be closing down, opening up, and going through that sort of manning. I cannot imagine having to tell those people that they've got a job, they don't have a job, and sorry it happened.
Madam Chairman, Representative Wisnett, that's not just forensics that went through that. That was the whole department. But thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Madam Chair, that concludes the testimony for the Support Services Bureau.
All right, thank you so much, and we look forward to seeing you during work session.
Yes, ma'am.
And thank you, Ms. Gilbert, for standing by. We appreciate that. I believe we are now ready to move into closing remarks from the superintendent. Good afternoon to you, sir.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Here comes the water.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and for the record, my name is Ronald C. Ricker, Superintendent of the Oregon State Police. It has been our pleasure to provide you with a glimpse of our very diverse organization as well as its mission. And as you have heard, we have broad responsibilities which result in service delivery expectations from a tremendous number of individuals and organizations throughout Oregon's public safety system. We certainly have appreciated the opportunity to respond to your questions and concerns and appreciate the spirit in which that you raise them. Early in the session, I met with the co-chairs and raised a number of issues, of course. You can imagine that chief among them was the need for dedicated funding to better stabilize our budget, and this remains a critical need. It's equally important, however, that we have a budget that we can actually execute without having to return to the legislature for a rebalance. During these budget hearings, you've heard about anticipated shortfalls in our Information Management Division, Forensic Services Division, as you just heard, and our Administrative Services Division. Unfortunately, this is nothing new. Over the past several biennia, we have known of similar shortfalls during the budget development process, and then, sure enough, have been before the emergency board time and again to rebalance. Rarely have these appearances been the result of unanticipated budget problems. If one didn't know our budget in detail, one might conclude that we haven't done a good job of executing our budget. The fact is, we have. We've been left to hold positions vacant or to not make critical purchases to pay for shortfalls that we all knew about ahead of time. In fact, we got into the practice of developing a business plan even before the beginning of a biennium to deal with problems that everybody knew we had in the budget. We've mitigated cut after cut, and most people agree that we've been cut way too much. So what I told the co-chairs is that we need to have a budget that we can execute except for the unexpected. In other words, our budget should be in balance at the start of the budget cycle based on the best information that's available to you. I therefore request that you address the shortfalls in forensics, information management, and administrative services before the budget is finalized, as Mr. Wilson was just talking about. If resources cannot be found to locate the issues, then we will make the staff and program cuts necessary to be in balance to the best of our ability. Of course, there will be consequences in those respective program areas, but we will do the best we can with the resources you allocate to us. In conclusion, in this area, I ask that you not fall victim to the temptation to take resources from the patrol division to fill the gaps. Others before you have done exactly that. Patrol looks like such a big line item that a million or two here or there may not seem unmanageable, but it is, and that's exactly what's happened time and again to the patrol division over the last 25 years. It's how we got to having no 24-hour coverage in Oregon. It's in part why 500 people are still being killed every year on our highways. And it's in part why we have had only the success we have had in stopping the free flow of narcotics up and down those same highways. Everybody, including the criminal element, knows we're probably not going to be out there. I also need and would like to address training. As you heard, training is an ongoing part of every employee's career. With respect to the training of recruit officers, I want to reiterate our support for the new DPSST Academy. We will be there as a partner to the best of our ability. Please, however, do not underestimate the task ahead of DPSST. Having a new building is just the beginning. The development of the training staff alone will be a long-term undertaking. We heard testimony in this room about the competency of police officers and what we should train to. The competency of police officers cannot be measured by the size of their department. In other words, just because a police officer works for a large agency does not guarantee they are competent. Likewise, a police officer in a small department may be the best there is anywhere. Rather, it's almost always about individual and organizational discipline. And this is what we strive for during our basic recruit school and throughout the officer's career. It's the little things, either done or not done, that shape both the officer and the agency. I believe as a general rule, you shouldn't hear much about the police in the news. Perhaps the occasional high-profile drug case, or, God forbid, another grisly traffic crash claiming too many lives. When you hear about police conduct, it's probably going to be one of a couple of things. Either an individual failure, because our people suffer the same stresses and problems as other people, or conduct that is symptomatic across an organization. It's the latter we can control by paying attention to individual and organizational discipline, as I mentioned. It starts at the basic academy, whether you call it military style or officer candidate style, and it must continue. In summary, members of the committee, our men and women, whether sworn or professional, are doing one heck of a job for the people of this state, even in the face of declining resources. In some cases, they refuse to fail, even though no one's been able to tell them when it's going to get better. Their dedication to duty is unwavering. In most cases, they don't even know who their customer is. But then again, they get their satisfaction from knowing that they and their organization are about doing the right thing. It really isn't any more complicated than that. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I ask you and your leadership to do the right thing for the Oregon State Police budget. We'll make Oregon a better place as a result. And I thank you and would answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much, Superintendent Ricker, for those excellent remarks. And please make your testimony, your written testimony, available for all of the committee. I know that other members who are currently absent are going to want to study your remarks. Please share the message with all of the members of the Oregon State Police that we respect them. We more than appreciate their fine service to the state. And believe me, you've made the case, and we clearly understand what the needs are on the financial side. We understand what you've been grappling with in terms of morale. We know that we have fine men and women serving our state through the Oregon State Police. So please take that message back to the agency. I want you to know that you have my commitment as chair of this committee. You have my commitment through my office to find that dedicated source of funding for the Oregon State Police. I will work with you toward that end.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnett?
No, ma'am. I please echo what you said. Appreciate your service. It does not sound like it's been a good experience, and I've had to tell people that their job is no longer there as we cut back to the military, and I know that's not an easy job and affects people's lives and families, and appreciate your service, Superintendent.
Thank you very much. I'll have my comments back to you before the end of the hearing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we have 13 people signed up for testimony. And I am going to ask each of you to speak for four or 5 minutes, no more than 5 minutes, please. And I will be calling the two people who traveled more than 100 miles to this meeting first. And they are Chris Brown, sheriff in Douglas County, and the second name begins with a T, and the last name is Lawrence.
Tara Lawrence.
Tara Lawrence? Yeah. Please come forward. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Madam Chair, just a reminder to the audience, if there's anyone else that wants to testify, there's still a sign-up sheet back there, so please sign up now so we can manage time.
And feel free to take the seats that are available as well. Sir, good afternoon, and thank you for traveling over.
Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm truly honored to be here to advocate for what I think is an absolutely essential component of Oregon's criminal justice infrastructure. The superintendent thanked me for coming, but the fact is that half of my motivation here is self-serving. When I arrived in Oregon in 1981, there were 29 troopers out of the Roseburg office. When I went to narcotics in 1988, there were two troopers on the interagency drug team. Today there are 9 troopers out of the Roseburg office and a conspicuous absence of state police presence on the interagency team. I think that over time we have compartmentalized this discussion a little bit in that it only affects the state police. The fact is that every trooper lost in Oregon, every trooper lost in Douglas County, means that I've lost a deputy sheriff. The work the troopers did does not go away because they don't exist anymore. It is my agency ultimately that picks up that burden, and sadly I think the burden is disproportionate. A trooper who spends 5 minutes writing a speeding citation at milepost 103 might mean that I don't have 4 deputies and medical and fire and ODOT at the 105 for hours on a fatal accident. A truck inspection done by a trooper in a few minutes might mean that I don't have 4 deputies dealing with traffic blocked both lanes of the freeway because an out-of-compliance driver rolled his tractor-trailer. A trooper who checks on what he thought was a stranded motorist and discovers the large meth lab in the trunk, like last week, allowed us to process the lab in a safe, static, contained environment and pursue the investigation to other counties expeditiously. Had the trooper not been there, that lab would be bubbling somebody's rental house, rental property today. And if we did discover it down the road, we would have to execute a search warrant where the risk of somebody getting hurt is very, very real. In my county, we do everything together. OSP is our honor major crimes team. They were formerly on our interagency narcotics team. We have trained together. We have developed policies together. We supplement one another and schedule to accommodate each other's special events and needs. We have divided our county so that each agency has primary responsibility for particular areas, and we help each other as needed. In a county a little bit bigger than Connecticut, if they aren't there, I start dropping the ball. There's too much to do. There's too much area. And too few resources available to serve the people effectively. I haven't mentioned the fact that we, over the same period of time, have lost a lot of human resources ourselves. We find ourselves increasingly confronted with situations where we have competing urgent demands, and we are forced to choose on what serious calls we respond to first. And that's an imperfect science. And if the one that we didn't choose goes sideways, you know, the people don't care why we weren't there. They just know the consequences of a public safety system that failed them. When we take this discussion one step further and we look at the issue not from policymakers, but from the police officer perspective, it is infinitely more ominous and personal. I've been involved in a lot of ugly situations, and I've had friends shot and wounded, shot and killed, killed in crashes, and on and on and on. But those things make some degree of sense. This is a dangerous occupation, and we don't always win, even when we have help. But the scariest call of all, and I remember this as vividly as the day I got it, was when I was dispatched to a large drunken disturbance. It goes without saying what the likelihood of weapons were. At a Hell's Angels kegger several miles up the Checo River at 3:30 in the morning. I was the only deputy in the county after midnight, and OSP went off at 2 a.m. It was just me. This wasn't the worst thing I'd been sent to, but it certainly was the scariest in terms of the threats and the resources available to me to cope with those threats. It was pretty easy to imagine how that was going to go, and the part that burns this into my memory is the fact that no police officer should have to confront those circumstances alone. That situation was unforgivable. And when the consequences of a bad day are that you don't go home, it's hard to reason how those in charge could devalue our personal safety to that extent. Deputies and troopers do that every day. They do it every night. In fact, there's fewer of us now than there were at that time. And this is the reality associated with a rural, largely remote state. Police officers can't decline calls because they're too dangerous. They can't decline calls because they're outnumbered 30-1. We can't reschedule calls because we are short of resources on a particular night, and our business doesn't function part-time. Our business is a 24/7 obligation. The only discretion involved, and the only potential factor in our favor, is the support we receive from the citizens and from our elected decision-makers and the value that they collectively place on the safety of their communities. Furthermore, as the House's grapple at the state and federal levels with a flurry of meth-related bills, the point I've tried to make for the last several months at both levels, is that statutorily we will have an enviable toolbox, and for that we are truly grateful. But there's nobody left to fight the fight. Task forces have collapsed around the state. A U.S. senator recently showed me Oregon statistics on meth lab seizures and commented on the decline in the meth labs and that we had prevailed and what an outstanding job we were doing and we were finally over the hump. He was delighted. The fact, of course, is that there are fewer task forces in Oregon, far fewer personnel working drug cases, and the work just isn't getting done. That's the primary reason for the decline in seizures, and if we don't bolster our task forces, and OSP is a critical element of those task forces, we won't have an enormous impact. We won't have any impact at all. In my county, OSP is the other half of an already crippled system. I can't be more sincere when I beg the Oregon legislature to bolster our state police, because I can tell you with crystal clear precision that if that doesn't happen, I can't keep the balls in the air. I thank you so much for your time, and any questions you have, I would be delighted to answer.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and again for traveling the distance to be here. And the urgent message has been heard. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon, Chair Gordley and members of the committee. My name is Tara Lawrence. I am the Sherman County District Attorney. I would like to thank the Chair and committee members for this opportunity to speak on behalf of the Oregon State Budget. I'd also like to thank Oregon State Police Lieutenant Colonel Williford for inviting me to share my thoughts and feelings and support for adequate funding that would enable Oregon State Police to provide the vital services for Oregonians. I'm honored to be here to share some of my outstanding experiences with Oregon State Police. In working with Oregon State Police, I've learned to expect what I would call professionalism plus. In addition, the officers are highly trained individuals with significant experience to draw upon in performing their work. One of the original missions of the Oregon State Police was to assist rural counties that face issues related to limited resources, officers in need of training, and high turnover in deputies. Currently in Sherman County, 4 deputies have left in the 2 years that I've been the district attorney. The current number of law enforcement officers in Sherman County is 3 plus the sheriff. For these reasons, smaller counties rely heavily on the highly trained officers with Oregon State Police with years of experience. It is tragic to watch the disintegration of the state's premier law enforcement agency from a force of 1,000 to not more than 300 over the last, for a little over 300 over the last 20 years. The same troopers that helped drive down Oregon's crime rate and who have committed their lives to keeping Oregon safe have watched their proud agency be reduced to a shadow of its former self. The Dalles Area Command provides vital services to 5 surrounding counties. My county, Sherman County, Wheeler, Gillum, Wasco, and Hood River, which is an extensive amount of mileage. Next, I'm going to talk to you about some of my personal experiences with Oregon State Police that I have had as the Sherman County District Attorney. The professional experiences have given me a great appreciation for the expertise and professionalism that the Oregon State Police officers bring to their work. For a small community like Sherman County, with a population of less than 1,800 citizens over an 831 square miles, the Oregon State Police services are vitally important to my county. Oregon State Police provides safety net of services, ensuring that justice in the criminal system is not denied to a smaller community. Oregon State Police's presence in my county provides access to officers who are professional, highly trained, and experienced. These officers, with their exposure to investigations involving situations that Sherman County rarely experiences or has never experienced. I can provide two recent examples. On January 4th, 2004, a defendant allegedly murdered a 2-year-old boy in my county. The defendant is charged with aggravated murder. Sherman County has not had a death penalty case in approximately 30 years. Oregon State Police's assistance in both the processing of the evidence and the conducting of the interviews was crucial to the investigation of the homicide. The sheriff's office is small, with only 3 deputies at the time of the murder. Clearly, the safety net provided at no cost to Sherman County will prove invaluable to the surviving family members who lost their 2-year-old son. The second example I'd like to talk about is the use of deadly physical force on March 8, 2005. These types of incidences are rare, especially in Sherman County, where there has never been a fatal officer-involved shooting. The Sherman County Sheriff fired the fatal shot, creating a politically sensitive homicide investigation. The mother of the deceased is the elected Sherman County Treasurer with an office directly next door to the Sheriff's Office. The Dallas Area Command immediately, headed up by Lieutenant Ashmore, who is present in the room today, immediately responded with 5 troopers in Grass Valley at the site where the suspect was barricaded in a home. The situation presented a life-threatening situation. Ultimately, Trooper Reiser with the Oregon State Police was forced to make a difficult decision and fire a shot. The necessity for outside investigation following the fatal shooting was clear. Oregon State Police immediately responded by providing independent investigators from Bend, Baker City, and Pendleton. They all arrived that evening. Many of them arrived prior to my arrival. The Oregon State Police Major Crime Team arrived immediately. SWAT was activated. The investigation was highly organized and conducted in a thorough and professional manner. Upon my arrival, I was greeted and quickly briefed. I was immediately impressed with the team and their willingness to answer my questions. The officers kept me informed during the investigation. At grand jury, 11 Oregon State Police officers were called as witnesses. Their testimony was greatly appreciated. Trooper Reiser's professionalism on March 8th particularly impacted or impressed me. Trooper Reiser, based upon being a highly trained individual and having a solid presence of mind on March 8th, after having just made the tremendously difficult decision to fire a shot at another human being, maintained the presence of mind once the subject was down to immediately secure his gun, open his trunk, retrieve first aid supply kits, and immediately render medical attention to the suspect that was down. That, to me, I learned that sometime later and was just completely impressed with his presence and professionalism, his state of mind. Oregon State Police provides assistance in a number of ways. With regard to this March 8th shooting, Trooper Greg Hastings provided invaluable guidance on press releases that were issued by my office. Lieutenant Hastings was generous with his time. He indulged me in my compulsive desire to manipulate words in my press releases. He ensured that the information that was put out to the media was accurate, fair, and fair to both parties, fair to the family that lost the child, but fair to law enforcement as well. he had a wealth of experience in dealing with the media that I just couldn't bring to the table. So I highly, I relied heavily upon Lieutenant Hastings. A third specialized service I've received in Sherman County from Oregon State Police has to do with my dealings with Oregon State Trooper Dan DeHaven as a crash reconstructionist. I've worked with him on a number of different cases. Trooper DeHaven's training and experience were critical in building a solid case involving the death of a six-week-old baby boy and significant injuries to his two-year-old sister. As the prosecutor, the well-built case enabled me to provide a successful prosecution of manslaughter 2, resulting in a tough sentence. The defendant in this case had previously driven drunk on 3 prior occasions. The end result here was the death of her own child.
D.A. Lawrence, are you near wrapping up?
Yes, I am. Next, I'd like to talk about the importance of public safety. At a time when so many other parts of state government has grown, it is unconscionable to allow further deterioration of such a critical part of government. The most important function of government is to secure the safety and freedom of Oregonians. Oregonians are entitled to be free of fear at home, at work, and last but not least, to be safe on the highways that we access. In conclusion, I can tell you as the elected DA of one of the Oregon's smallest counties, we would suffer greatly without the supports provided by Oregon State Police to our law enforcement system. I can speak, if not for all of my fellow prosecutors who consider Oregon State Police a vital partner in the job in protecting Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And again, we thank you for making the trip over from Sherman County. And you referenced a Lieutenant Ashmore who also traveled?
Yes, I did, over. And he is present.
Lieutenant?
Madam Chair.
Ashmore, would you like to stand and be recognized? Thank you for being here.
Madam Chair, I do have written testimony. Shall I set it over here?
Please.
Okay.
Thank you very much. The next panel, Al Elkins, Oregon Hunters Association, and Cy J. M. Hill.
Yes, ma'am.
Confederated Tribes of the Silets. And they will be followed by Walt Begley, or Walt, I hope that's correct, Marion County DA, and Gordon O'Brien with APSME.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, Al Elkins with the Oregon Hunters Association. I'm here briefly to talk about Game Enforcement Division and how important they are. They are a priority for the Oregon Hunters Association. We are an 11,000-member conservation organization that puts a lot of money, volunteer time, and effort on the ground each year. And we believe that this is one way to preserve habitat and wildlife, but another way is to ensure that the funding level for OSP enforcement officers, game enforcement officers, be maintained and not diminish their presence in the field enforcing game laws. And if you look at the presentation that they gave at the level one briefing before you, their overall compliance rate for big game species in 2003-2004 was 85.6. They had approximately over 71,000 hours directed towards protection of big game species, and 88,000 hours were focused on all hunting within the state. We need to maintain those hours and maintain the presence in the forest and protecting our game. We appreciate their service and ask the committee to continue their funding level. On the way back from a hearing on cougars in Baker City, we were traveling the old highways back because cell reception is so poor there, and we came upon an OSP officer that was getting out of his car, putting on his jacket, and going into the woods to enforce game laws. And it brought everything together that we had talked about at the Level 1 and Level 2 hearings, from the training to the fact that he was the only officer within 100 miles of that area, I would assume. And so it all brought it all together for me. I just wanted to share that with you, that we appreciate their presence. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairperson Gordley and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cy J.M. Hill. I'm the Executive Director of the Sletz Tribal Gaming Commission. I'm representing the Confederated Tribes of Sletz Indians of Oregon. I am pleased to present testimony about the Oregon State Police proposed Tribal Gaming Section 2005 to 2007 budget on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Sletz Indians of Oregon. The Sletz Tribe has had a gaming operation open since March 1995, operating under a compact for regulation of Class 3 gaming negotiated between the state and the tribe. Our relationship with the Oregon State Police has been a cooperative and professional one. At the same time, there exists a mandate under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act that tribal gaming revenues, to the extent they are not needed to cover operational and regulatory oversight costs, be used to provide services and benefits to the tribal members in the local community. The Sletz Tribe strongly believes that the proposed tribal gaming section budget is excessive in certain regards, and that the Oregon State Police can provide the same or a higher level of regulatory oversight at a less cost. Let me give you some examples. Currently, the Oregon State Police Gaming Enforcement Division Tribal Gaming Section utilizes sworn officers to provide regulatory oversight of Indian gaming in Oregon as set out in the compact. The unit is currently authorized 16.5 FTE. Since July 2001, the Tribal Gaming Section has had 35 individuals assigned to this unit, a 100% turnover. With this type of turnover, it is highly unlikely that any expertise or continuity of services can be maintained. The tribe spends numerous hours familiarizing and training the new officers that are assigned to monitor the casinos. The new state officers usually have no experience within the gaming industry and spend many hours all charged to the tribes in standardized training to reacquire the expertise that the last officers had. By the time the new officers acquired a basic level of experience in gaming, they leave, usually to retirement. There is no stability in the operation of the tribal gaming section, and the Sletz Tribe believes this instability is systematic in the way the section is set up and staffed. The Sletz Tribe recommends that the state examine how it conducts business of monitoring the tribe's 9 gaming facilities. We would suggest that the current structure of the Oregon State Police Tribal Gaming Section is insufficient and ill-prepared to meet the responsibilities under the state tribal gaming compacts. The Sletz Tribe proposes that the state utilize non-sworn individuals to staff the Oregon State Police Tribal Gaming Section to the extent feasible. Very little of the work in the section involves criminal investigations or other duties that can be carried out by a sworn officer. In a related context, for example, the Oregon State Police Gaming Enforcement Division's own testimony stated the following regarding the replacement of sworn officers with non-sworn individuals in the lottery division. I am quoting, in an effort to increase the effectiveness and efficiency of security at the Oregon State Lottery, a restructure and realignment of responsibilities were implemented within lottery security. This involved identifying security non-law enforcement related responsibilities versus investigative law enforcement responsibilities and assigning staff accordingly. In doing so, 4 state police sworn positions were removed and replaced with 4 civilian lottery security specialists. The effort has been a success. The Sletz Tribe would like to see the same type of program implemented for the tribal gaming section. The Oregon Tribes previously suggested this change to the tribal gaming section of OSP, but it was rejected out of hand. The following facts directly support this type of program for the tribal gaming section. In the tribal gaming section 2001-2003 biennium, only 6.5% of the total time by sworn officers was spent on criminal investigations. This trend has continued into the 2003-2005 biennium, with only 6.3% of sworn officers' time being spent on criminal investigations. The tribal gaming section spends a considerable amount of time traveling. In the 2001-2003 biennium, the tribal gaming section billed a total of 99,690 hours to the tribes. Travel was 32% of the total time billed to the tribes. Travel was the largest expense to each tribe in the state. As a policy matter, the tribal gaming section has refused to delegate any of its enforcement or investigation authority regarding gaming-related criminal activity to local officers or jurisdictions. Such delegation would reduce travel costs and investigation time. In addition to reducing expense, local jurisdictions for the Sletch tribe have indicated that they would be willing to provide this type of service to the tribe. This option would also reduce liability for the Sletch tribe. For example, the Sletch tribe and OSP are currently being sued by 5 individuals suspected of and later absolved of criminal activity who were detained by the casino on OSP's order until the OSP officer was able to travel from Salem to Lincoln City and interview the individuals, which was over an hour and a half later. Additionally, since October 2002, routine monitoring conducted by the tribal gaming section has not revealed any significant regulatory deficiencies by any tribe conducting gaming in Oregon. This is not meant as a justification to eliminate regulatory oversight, but to show that the need for on-site sworn officers is not as critical as the OSP asserts. By properly assigning sworn and non-sworn individuals to the tribal gaming section, the Oregon State Police could have a more effective unit and utilize sworn officers for far more important duties. In closing, the Sletch tribe supports a sufficiently funded and effective OSP tribal gaming section. At the same time, this support is not justification for diverting critical funds from tribal services to the extent they are not needed for regulatory oversight. The Sletch tribe supports an OSP tribal gaming section budget that replaces the number of slots designated for sworn officers with slots for non-sworn officers. Since the OSP rejected this proposal and the tribes have no other recourse on this issue under the compacts with the state, the Oregon legislature is the only avenue of relief for the tribes. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments for the panel?
Madam Chair, I don't know about looking at the contract. Mr. Wilson, should this matter be referred to audit committee? Or do you?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisner, I suppose that would be one option. This is it's not really a contract as much as a compact, which there are some significant differences in how they're treated. But it's something we can look into.
Thank you very much for coming forward. We appreciate your time.
I have written testimony. You want me to leave it over?
If you would, please. Thank you. And I overlooked, let me double check something here. Phil Donovan and Steve Mathers, did the two of you travel more than 100 miles to be here?
I did, yes.
You did? Okay, I'm going to call you up next. I'm sorry.
My body's still working.
I have you both signed up. Okay, come on up. Okay.
Thank you, Chair Gordley, members of the committee. My name is Phil Donovan. I work on behalf of the Oregon Guides and Packers Association. And with me is Steve Mathers, president of the Oregon Guides and Packers Association, and an outfitter from Central Oregon. And just briefly, we're here to speak to the importance of the Oregon State Police Fish and Game Division and the duties that they handle. As you are aware, Oregon State Police are responsible for enforcement of fish and game laws, and no one else in the state does the kind of work that they are doing. Not only do they patrol for fish and game violations, they also help keep the waters and the woods of Oregon safe, and their work is perilous. It is oftentimes done in remote locations, and we are indebted to the service that they provide. Frankly, without their work, our outdoor businesses would fail. The era of Endangered Species Act listings makes the issue of high compliance rates very important. Without assured compliances, quite frankly, we see closures. And in fact, at times, we don't even get openings. An example is in 2000, in the Portland area, there was an opportunity to open up a 7-day-a-week salmon fishery on the Willamette. Yet, Oregon State Police Fish and Game Division had recently been cut at the time, and they didn't have the officers to be able to provide compliance with the anglers on this kind of a new fishery. It had been previously open only 2 days a week, and now the opportunity to get to go to 7 days a week, they just didn't have the manpower. So five sport fishing businesses pooled private dollars and helped hire two state police officers out of retirement to come and help kick this fishery off. While we were able to do that for a couple of weeks, doing that statewide, doing that year-round is impractical. Already, we contribute significantly through the transfer from the Department of Fish and Wildlife for hunter and angler license dollars. We worked on the Measure 66 campaign to provide lottery funds for parks and salmon restoration. And then we came to the legislature and advocated for the use of some of those funds, those Measure 66 funds, for law enforcement. In addition, our outdoor businesses contribute significantly to the state's general fund. So our request is simple. We'd like this body to maintain and hold the line on the Fish and Game Division at Oregon State Police. With that, I'll turn to Steve for some comments.
Yeah, I was just Representative Senator Portley. My name is Steve Mathers. I'm president of Oregon Guys and Packers. I just came to say how important it is to our businesses that we have maintained the Oregon State Police Game Division, and if possible, to increase it, because we work closely with the game officers and they're, you know, in our program, and we need support out there on our every chance we can. That's all I had to say.
Mr. Mathers, where in Central Oregon are you from?
I live in Bend.
In Bend.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Thank you very much
for
making the trip over.
Madam Speaker.
Representative Wisnett, thank you for elevating me this afternoon. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the testimony from my friend down in Bend and from Mr. Donovan. Mr. Wilson, didn't we hear that the state police gets about any amount of money they want from the Department of Fish and Wildlife for this function? There was no limitation, or they had extra money? Why did we have to have... I thought that was the testimony.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisner, I wouldn't denote it as being unlimited money. I think that what you saw was, over time, a reduction in the share of the fees and hunting and licensing fees that have gone to the state police for enforcement versus other uses of those funds is, I think, some of the information you saw. And then it's really an agreement between the within the legislature on how much is allocated to ODFW purposes and how much is for game and fish enforcement and state police.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Sir,
I'm sorry, Mr. Wilson. I thought the testimony was that they give them a bill and that they, you know, we talked about who, you know, they said this is what we need to perform our mission to Fish and Wildlife, and there was money there.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisner, I'm not sure what the ending balances are right now or how much is available in revenues this particular biennium, but I mean, there is an unlimited amount for sure, and this, in fact, of any of the divisions, probably in, with the exception of probably the gaming division, this division has remained relatively stable in staffing because of its funding source, more so than anything else.
I guess then, Madam Chair, Mr. Donovan, Mr. Mathers, I'd ask you to come back to me next time if you have to, and we'll work with the state police and help them get that funds from the Fish and Wildlife, because the state police is the middle person that they're billing their sources. So you haven't had to do that again, is that correct? You've just the 1 year?
Well, Senator Gorley, Representative Wisnan, if I might, I mean, first off, there is a limit to how much ODFW can transfer over, and that's based on, you know, the level of our hunting and fishing license fees. Last session, we advocated for and was able to pass the largest fee increase in ODFW's history as a percentage. And so it's important to us to see that those dollars are spent effectively and efficiently. And part of Oregon State Police, their work, as we've seen, you know, in the field, is so important to being able to make the businesses we represent go.
Gotcha.
Again, thank you both, and thanks for making that trip over.
And thanks for indulging me.
Thank you. Thank you. The district attorney from Marion County, and thank you for your patience, sir.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Walt Beglaw, and I'm the district attorney of Marion County. I'm here to express my support for the Oregon State Police budget for the biennium. The state police provide an integral and collaborative working relationship to the district attorneys in seeking justice and with all of the other public safety partners. I spent my entire 15 years as a prosecutor and to this day working side by side, in particular with patrol, effectively providing frontline public safety on our roads, top-notch accident investigation, and criminal vehicular death investigations that are the best bar none. The detective sections have demonstrated an uncompromising commitment to this county and beyond. They are through objective, detailed investigations. They are professional. They provide training. They are vital links to our multidisciplinary teams, which are mandated by statute, that bring together the partners of each community. Their assistance in homicide investigations as of late here in Marion County is remarkable and an integral part of what we do to provide safety to every citizen in our communities. And they are a part of our, here we call it HART, our homicide response team, but other counties have similar teams that work together, and the state police is a huge part of that. And there's really no price to put on that contribution. Statewide, and specifically for today's testimony, the Forensic Services Division is an absolute necessary component to the justice system. You've heard all that they do, the forensic analysis, identification, all of this work that starts from the very beginning and works its way into a fine product to provide the truth in a court of law. And so we are all reliant on that expertise that's provided through that division, and I personally have used that expertise to support decisions that we make day to day in the district attorney's office. That within that division, continued sustainable funding is not just important, it is imperative. And during this last drastic cuts that they suffered, I have to admirably state that they strive to provide the service under those cuts. And quite frankly, one of the most admirable qualities is their ability to communicate, particularly during tough times, and they're still doing it today. And I am privileged to be here to support their budget. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to be here and support the Oregon State Police and their budget. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor.
Next, we have a panel, four witnesses from AFSCME. I'm going to call you up two at a time. Gordon O'Brien and Mark
Fortner.
Is it Fortner?
Fortner, F-O-R-K-N-E-R.
Please come forward. Good afternoon, and if you'd like to start.
Good afternoon. I'm Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gordon O'Brien. I am the president of AFSCME Local 896, the union that represents the support staff of the state police and many of the classified employees.
Sir, would you pull that microphone closer to you?
Is that better?
Yes, it is. Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm also an employee of the state police. I work at the Forensics Lab in Springfield. I've been an employee of the department 11 years. I spent 9 years in Portland. And as a result of funding cuts due to the layoffs 2 years ago, I voluntarily transferred to the Springfield lab to fill a vacancy since that lab lost all of its support staff. And I've been down there working for the last 2 years. But with me, several of my co-workers from other areas were all on a long time here today. We represent people in the patrol offices, the support staff, the support staff at headquarters, ID services, criminal background check areas, fingerprint sections, the firearms section, LEDs, and forensics, as well as support staff in other offices around the state. We're here to urge the adequate funding of the department so that we can do the job that the citizens of the state have requested of us and do that as effectively as possible. The proposed budget is short on the revenue funds that would allow us to sufficiently do our jobs in the best manner possible without having to do layoffs as a result of shortfalls. Our belief is that it's also the troopers as well as the support staff that are vital components of the agency, and so we're asking for adequate funding for both portions of things. Part of the areas, like specifically that I'm aware of, are in the forensics arena. There are several thousand convicted offender samples up in the Portland lab waiting for DNA analysis. That number is growing at approximately 1,000 samples per month as a result of funding issues. There are, in the patrol offices, there are citations that are written by officers that could be 2 months down the road before that they are actually processed. During the layoffs, several of the offices lost their one support person that they had, so those citations would either have to be entered by a trooper or those citations be sent to another office for somebody else to enter. So a traffic stop that happens, say, around President's Day could take until April or May until that information has been entered, which could delay critical information for future traffic stops or possible arrests if the person was had a warrant out for their arrest. That wouldn't have been actually that part would have been known, but the information for the traffic stop may not be entered in a timely manner due to the lack of support staff that we have in the areas. Also, with the concern of being able to process evidence, there are several cases in the state patrol offices around the state that the evidence has been collected but has not been able to be sent to the lab for analysis, as well as the same scenarios with every other state police office, as well as the cities and the counties have not been able to submit evidence that they've been holding on to because we haven't had the full funding resources to analyze that evidence for them. One of the things that we make sure we do is not only find who's guilty, but we also look at ruling out the suspects that have been submitted that weren't the ones that committed those crimes. We look at the issues in a non-biased manner and have found just as many people that were accused of crimes innocent, or not, at least not in that specific case, as we have found the people that were guilty in those crimes. So adequate funding is definitely a concern for us at this point. And thank you for your time. And if there's any other questions you have for me, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I am Mark Faulkner. I work at ID Services for the State Police. And I wanted to explain kind of what it is that we do over at ID Services. We are sort of the behind the scenes for the State Police. We do regulatory checks. We do background checks on individuals for state employment, as well as for volunteers who work with children or the elderly or disabled folks. And we keep current the criminal histories that are maintained by the state police. And without the adequate amount of folks to be able to do this, we fall behind on keeping those records current. We have a backlog on dispositions, the outcomes of what happens in the courts, to be put onto somebody's criminal history. If they've been arrested, it'll show on their criminal history they've been arrested for whatever charge it may be. Until we get a court disposition and we have the staff to be able to update that record to show that the outcome of that disposition, it's a charge with no end on it. If a person was found guilty or not, you wouldn't know. And we are currently thousands of dispositions behind due to the fact that we don't have adequate staffing to keep up on it. I currently do backgrounds for, like I said, for the regulatory unit, which does for the employment of state employees, and we process approximately 4,000 background checks a month, and we are running around 7 or 8 days behind on getting those run. Once they come into our possession, it takes us that long before we can touch them and actually work on them. I also work for the clearinghouse unit, which is the unit that does the background checks for the folks who work with the children, disabled, and elderly. And we do about 400 or so background checks on those types of individuals. And here again, we are running around 7 to 10 days behind. It's critical that we have the folks available to be able to keep these criminal histories up to date. For the troopers on the road, if they've come across somebody that they're checking on, the criminal offense may not even be in there because we haven't got the staff to be able to put it in there in a timely manner. The person could be wanted and they wouldn't know because it hasn't been put in there. You can see where all this would be. It's an important issue that these records be kept current, not only for Oregon, but for nationwide. Checks are done through the FBI and link it through the Oregon to be able to look at this information. It needs to be current and accurate. We need to keep the troopers safe that are out on the roads, and we need to be able to make intelligent decisions on who's going to be working with the children of the state, as well as who the state's going to employ and who's going to be foster parents, et cetera, et cetera. And so I would like to stress the fact that we need to have adequate funding for ID services and state police in general, so that we can provide this service to the troopers on the roads as well as all of the citizens of the state of Oregon. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to take your questions.
Thank you, sir. Representative Wisnett, I know that you are particularly interested in the area of background checks. Did you wish to inquire?
Madam Chair, thank you. No, I think there's a lot of questions I'd have about just learning how the process is, and I may want to make a trip down to the state police and go through this. I appreciate the testimony.
Feel free to drop by. We'd
like to go down and see how it works. Because you're just inputting. You're not the investigators, they bring you stuff and you can check it from your data bank, or are you just inputting them?
We get a 10-print fingerprint card. Excuse me if I'm not being of the right protocol here.
I didn't go through the chair either.
I apologize.
You're fine.
We receive a 10-print fingerprint card from the agency, and we scan that into our system and run it through the state of Oregon, through the WIN system, the Western Identification Network, as well as through the FBI, and then whatever criminal histories we come across that belong to that person, that's how we determine if they should or should not be doing whatever it is they are planning to do. Most of the regulatory side of it, with the state agencies are trying to hire folks or be foster parents, et cetera, we return all of that information to them for them to make the decision. And the clearinghouse unit is a little different. We run background checks for private organizations such as Boys and Girls Clubs or all these little organizations out there that have no way of being able to do this. And the difference when we do that is that we gather all the information, get the criminal histories, and then make the determination for them based on criteria that they have told us to look for. Mm-hmm. And so they get a letter from us saying that John Smith is approved or denied based upon the criteria that organization has set forth. But we are taking the prints, we are running them through the AFIS system, and then whatever criminal information we can find, we base decisions on that or disseminate back to the organizations to the regulatory process.
I think, Madam Chair, I appreciate this briefing, sir, but I think it would be best. I'll go down and spend some time maybe with them and see what. We had 3 bills in the House today we didn't get to address. It was talking about background checks and the fact that we were going to destroy the FBI or files or something when we inputted this. I didn't understand that either. So I'll do that for us, Madam Chair. Good on.
Very good. Mr. Faulkner, you indicated that you're thousands behind in entering the dispositions.
Yes, ma'am.
And you also referenced 7 or 8 days, being behind 7 or 8 days in a number of other, or at least two other categories.
Yes.
With regard to the dispositions, are you 7 or 8 days behind on those, or is it months?
I would say it's months and months.
And can you tell us what kind of hours are you working, and what's the stress like, knowing that you're working with that kind of backlog?
It's a identification service is a 24/7 operation, and so we have all three shifts that are going 24 hours a day.
Are you working overtime?
No, we are not.
No overtime. Okay.
We do what we can with the staff that we have. Within the constraints of an 8-hour day per person. We currently have, I believe it is 14 vacancies in identification services that have been frozen just for budgetary reasons. And I'd say that the stress level is getting high. Everybody's trying to do the best they can and trying to produce as much as they can, but you can see after months and months and months how that would drain you. We're holding our own, I'd say, but I can't see this going on for much longer at these current levels anyway.
Thank you very much for coming forward with your testimony, both of you.
Thank you.
Melody Mole and Dana Denherder. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Melody Mole, and I work at ID Services for Oregon State Police Firearms Unit. In the Firearms Unit, we take all of the calls from all of the licensed dealers in the state of Oregon and process transactions to see if someone is qualified to purchase a firearm or not. By law, we're mandated to be open from 8 in the morning to 10 o'clock at night, 7 days a week, which is Christmas and Thanksgiving off. So we process a lot of transactions during that time. Excuse me. I'm here to talk about the fact that we are so short-staffed. In our unit alone, we're down 7 positions. That puts a lot of burden on the people that are still there. Last night, as an example, we had 2 call takers taking calls from throughout the state of Oregon, dealers, at 4:30 in the afternoon, which is one of our busiest times. So we're talking about high hold waits. Last night it got up to almost 9 minutes with 12, 13 calls in the queue waiting to be picked up. So we're working very hard, trying to work very hard with what we have. My personal fear is when you're rushed, you're making errors. If we do make a mistake, we give somebody a gun. It makes me sick to think that I have to put a trooper's life in danger to go out and retrieve that weapon. We do keep a lot of guns off, you know, from people that should not have them, which I'm very proud of. And so basically I'm just here to say we have a lot of dedicated employees. We're losing a lot of them to other positions, other jobs, because we've been frozen for 3 years. And so the whole time and the dealer's loss of revenue is a big concern to us. There has been times where we've had a 40-minute hold, 30, 40 people in the queue, and so our call takers are just really trying to play catch-up. In another area, we also help out with processing cards and dispositions for ID services, and we have not been able to do that much here lately. As a result of that, if you take the people in our unit, it comes out to about somewhere around $175,000 a year, cards or dispositions that we were unable to help out with. So that delays their process in processing those cards. If those cards aren't processed in a timely manner, our police officers do not see those arrests. they aren't aware when they stop someone that they've recently been convicted of a felony or they have a restraining order. We are not aware. We might give the gun to someone that shouldn't have the gun. I don't know how many times I've ran a transaction and I've saw that someone went to court the day before or a restraining order was issued the week before. If that hadn't been processed, we would have given that person a weapon. So I believe what we do is very important, and I'm proud of the work we do and working for OSP. Is there any questions? Thank you very much. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and the committee. My name is Dana Denherter, and I'm the Vice President of AFSCME Local 896, as well as a Criminal Justice Information Specialist in the Operations Center for LEDS. We are one of many support divisions for the state police. LEDS provides 24-hour service 7 days a week and support to not only district attorneys, courts, records departments, 911 centers, who support law enforcement agencies in Oregon, but across the nation and to Canada, some parts of Mexico, and we do serve as a liaison with Interpol. We are literally the backbone of information for our users due to our crime databases and the message switch that communicate with other states. The folks that you hear testify today, Ms. Mullen, Mr. Faulkner, we maintain that on our databases. LEDS also has several investigative assistance tools that officers throughout the state use, as their own agencies could not afford the fees or the services. So we centralize that resource for them, and the investigations that we help on have to do with homicides, missing persons, subjects involved in drug manufacturing, as well as many other serious crimes. Without LEDS, backgrounds on teachers, medical professionals, and other professionals would not be able to be run and transmitted. This would severely impact the safety of our children, our elders, and potentially every other citizen in the state. And without LEDS, officer safety would be strongly impacted, as criminal information would not be able to be accessed or transmitted through the LEDS system. LEDS also provides a training certification for our users. At this time, the training center or section is preparing information on new border crossing license plate recognition in cooperation with the United States Custom Border Protection and International Justice and Public Safety Information Sharing Network. And so they also do some very important work. We also provide after-hours services for the Department of Motor Vehicles for law enforcement agencies. We provide vehicle information or photos if folks should request on criminal cases. Once again, kidnappings, homicides, suicidal subjects, they've left, they don't have their vehicle information. They give us a call, and we're able to get that out to them within minutes. To save money and maintain our services, LEDS was merged with ORS, which is the Oregon Response, Oregon Emergency Response Systems, which is also a 24/7 answering point for state agencies such as DEQ, the Oregon Military Department, Fish and Wildlife, OSHA, and several other state agencies that are too numerous to mention. We receive the calls, take reports, allocate resources for the incidents, such as shipping vessels that have sunk, search and rescue missions, meth lab cleanups, workplace fatalities and injuries, as well as many other incidents, some of them that you might recall that occurred last week that were significant were the white powder incidents at the Salem post offices. We had three ships that ran aground. We had meth lab cleanups, as well as a fish kill in Eugene. As technology continues to change and crimes continue to rise, the staff position we lose, as well as the funds for our investigative tools and our training resources, not only impact the employees or the LEDS section, it impacts the safety of every officer in the state, as well as the safety of our community members and any other law enforcement agencies that may look to us from out of state for information on subjects. So I appreciate the opportunity to bring this to your attention through the eyes of as a worker bee. And if you have any questions, let me know.
Well, we appreciate very much that you are that worker bee. Thank you. And thank you both. Thank you. Dan Swift and Roger Martin.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Daniel Swift. I am a trooper for the state of Oregon. I'm also currently the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. I'm here this afternoon to try and put somewhat of a human face on what up to now has been a budget process filled mainly with numbers and statistics, and to answer some questions and expand on some statements that have been made by this committee. I believe it was during Phase 1 that Senator Devlin made a very insightful statement about troopers being asked to go in harm's way without backup, and perhaps the state is asking too much of the officers at this point. I believe that is a fair analysis. All of us who go into police work realize the job is hazardous when we accept the badge. Society pays us to stand guard over the public, to protect the helpless, and to defend those who cannot defend themselves. And sometimes in the defense of that society, we in law enforcement are asked to sacrifice our lives for the protection of that society. That is a risk and a responsibility that we freely accept when we accept the badge of our office. We are, to use a well-known phrase, the thin blue line that separates civilized society from anarchy. We ensure that society lives by the rule of law instead of the law of the jungle. Unfortunately, in Oregon over the past few years, the thin blue line has become almost transparent. Due to budget cuts in recent years, there are no 24-hour-a-day state police offices left anywhere in this state. That means that most of rural Oregon, as you heard in such as Sherman County, where they have only three deputies, goes to bed at night and awakes in the morning without basic police protection. And nighttime is when criminals are the most active, transporting their drugs, stealing our property, looking for their next victim. As police officers, we are expected to take reasonable risks in the furtherance of our duty to protect society. We are not expected to take on risks from which there is little or no probability of survival. Yet that is what we in the state police are being asked to do with ever-increasing frequency. Take on unacceptable risks. I'm going to give you a hypothetical but all too real situation. You are now a state trooper. You are patrolling Highway 97. It's approximately 2 o'clock in the morning. And you are driving through a rest area. You see a suspicious car with 5 occupants in it. The car isn't stolen. No crime is occurring that you can see, but you know, based on because of your instincts and your training, that something is wrong and these guys are up to no good. Unfortunately, you also know that you are the only trooper on duty within 100 miles. The local sheriff's department is also off duty, as is often the case in rural Oregon. And their nearest city police officer is a good half hour away doing what that city is paying him to do, keeping them safe. My question to each of you is, what do you do? Do you contact these suspicious characters, knowing full well that if something goes wrong, it will be at least 30 minutes before help can get to you? Or do you just make a note of it and decide that this time, discretion is the better part of valor? Members of this committee, that is the dilemma faced by your state troopers every single day. And it doesn't have to be a criminal contact for things to go bad. Slightly over 1 year ago, Trooper Nick Novell contacted what he believed to be a lost motorist at the Valley of the Rogue rest area between Medford and Grants Pass. Instead of being helpful, Trooper Novell was confronted with an armed bank robber and parolee who was wanted out of Nevada, and who had promised that he was not going back to prison. In the ensuing gun battle, the suspect was killed and Trooper Novell was shot in the collarbone area above his ballistic vest. That bullet is still lodged there to this day, and Nick Novell will carry that bullet with him for the rest of his life. Last summer, Trooper Don Newcomb out of the Gilcrest office was involved in a high-speed pursuit of an impaired driver. When the suspect vehicle finally ran out of road and stopped, Trooper Newcomb was not only confronted by an intoxicated and uncooperative female driver, but by her uncooperative and intoxicated boyfriend passenger, who also happened to be a wanted and convicted felon. It took the closest law enforcement officer, who happened to be another OSP trooper, 25 minutes to arrive on scene and back up Trooper Newcomb. For 25 minutes, Trooper Newcomb, all alone, was forced to wait and control two intoxicated, uncooperative people, neither of which had a whole lot of incentive to go along with the program and cooperate. Yet he did, and they were both taken into custody. On September 19, 2003, Trooper Lynn Withers stopped a vehicle for speeding on Highway 38 just west of Elkton in Douglas County. During the contact, the driver of the stopped vehicle became irate and attacked Trooper Withers. During the assault, Trooper Withers sustained a broken leg and a severely twisted ankle. Trooper Withers was able to call for help, but the closest available law enforcement unit was a Bureau of Land Management law enforcement ranger. That was the closest one available. It took this officer 12 minutes to arrive on scene to help Trooper Withers. Fortunately for Trooper Withers, while he was fighting for his life with a broken leg,
Two civilians drove by and decided to get involved. One of these civilians was a retired deputy sheriff. Between the three of them, they finally managed to get the suspect into custody before the BLM ranger arrived. On a side note, the suspect was a convicted felon in possession of methamphetamine, as well as being under the influence of methamphetamine. He was also a volunteer firefighter from a local community. In this case, had a retired deputy sheriff not happened to be driving by at this critical time, Trooper Withers would probably have not survived this encounter. I would suggest that it is very much a bad idea to rely on divine intervention as a standard method to keep our troopers safe. In California, the California Highway Patrol regulations require two officers per car between the hours of 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. Two officers per car. California puts two officers in every single one of their patrol cars. In Oregon, we are lucky if we can put one trooper in every county. This is what the lack of an adequate budget means to the men and women who are still out there on the road. I also wanted to briefly address the methamphetamine issue. The current meth epidemic did not spring suddenly full-blown upon us. Just as nature abhors a vacuum, so does crime. And crime will flourish where there is an absence of law enforcement. In the early 80s, violent crime rates skyrocketed across the United States. Although a variety of factors played into the surge in crime, one of the primary causes was society's inability to keep its most violent offenders away from the rest of us. Eventually, the people become fed up with feeling afraid, and they passed a variety of laws in multiple states aimed directly at keeping the most violent felons locked up and behind bars. Today, the violent crime rate is way down from the early 80s. Now, unfortunately, a new plague has arisen to afflict us, and it has thrived in the absence of an adequate law enforcement presence. Properly funded and staffed police agencies are akin to preventive maintenance. You can pay now or you can pay later. Well, the bill has come due, and this legislature is being confronted with the penny-wise, pound-foolish policies of legislatures gone by. Today, 85% of all property crimes in the state of Oregon are directly or indirectly linked to methamphetamine usage. Unfortunately, there are no cheap, easy, or quick cures for this scourge. It is going to take a substantial investment by this state in detection, apprehension, and treatment. Fighting the methamphetamine epidemic is a very labor-intensive effort, both on the treatment side and on the apprehension side. And you have to invest in both components. If not, the whole effort is wasted because it just won't work. On the apprehension side, there is no substitute at all for warm bodies in police cars. We are the first line of defense in this war on the meth epidemic, but we are inadequately staffed to do the job. Laws are only effective if the government that passes them has the ability to enforce them. Until this state gets serious about funding an adequate state police force to enforce the laws that you pass, any efforts aimed at stopping this plague are doomed to failure. Members of this committee, I am begging you to fund us properly so that we can do what we are trained to do and protect the citizens of this state. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. And you have copies of your testimony
for, I do, Madam Chair,
for the committee. And we'll make sure that that gets distributed to every legislator.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll do that. Mr. Martin.
Madam Chair, my name is Roger Martin. I'm the lobbyist for the Confederate Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. I would endorse everything that you've heard about the state police budget and the need for adequate support both for their criminal activities and for their traffic safety, which I think few of us could ever criticize. I do, however, want to go back to one narrow area of the state police budget, and that's the tribal gaming enforcement section of the budget. And I would like to add my words to those of the representative from the Siletz tribe and give you a brief history. Some decade and a half ago, tribes in the state of Oregon moved towards opening casinos, and compacts were signed to the state of Oregon. At that time, all of us, including the tribes, were unsure of what the law enforcement needs would be, what the criminal activity might be. There was a great concern that we keep the, quote, mafia-type operations out of the state of Oregon. And we worked very closely. We established a fairly sizable state police budget, and we worked very closely with the state police. Several things have happened in the ensuing time. Number one, all the tribes discovered that this economic engine was vital to their existence, and the last thing they were going to do is screw it up by allowing any criminal activity to happen. And the enforcement level by the tribes has grown to the point that I can look you in the eye and say we really don't need the state police. Now, the state police shouldn't go away. State Police should be there to audit what goes on, to monitor what goes on. But as you heard earlier, what we have now in the State Police Tribal Gaming Enforcement is a turnover. We are now, the tribal people are now the experts, and they are the ones that don't know as much about it. And I can look you in the eye and tell you they need to charge the tribes less than they're doing and do less. Your staff pointed out the two parts of the state police budget that haven't changed much over the years are the fish and wildlife enforcement and tribal gaming. That's because there's a dedicated source of revenue. They don't rely on the general fund. And we have patiently, and I'm saying this on behalf of all the tribes, we've patiently gone to the governor, we've gone to the state police and said, we'd like to talk to you about it, and we get ignored. Now, if I were running the Oregon State Police, I guess with all my other money problems, I probably would be hesitant to give up in this area. But you have to look at it because we have no other place to go. We wrote a letter to the governor in October. Nothing's come of that. We need this committee to take a look at that gaming enforcement. We would suggest a reduction of what they're charging the tribes by 10%. It will have no effect on the enforcement. It will have no effect on any criminal activity. I just think it's something that should be done. Your predecessor in the last two sessions of this on this committee promised that, yes, we will do something about it. That was Senator Devlin's predecessor. And in 2001, he, quote, told me he forgot to do it. And in 2003, the chair of this committee, who was a House committee member, said, we will do it, and then was told by the co-chairs at the end of the session, look, we've hammered the state police so bad, just leave that one alone. Now, there's no justification for the amount of money that we have to pay, and I would ask you to seriously take a look at it, because you're the only jury we have left to get fairness out of this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. We will take a look. Would you be willing to make the letter that you sent to the governor available?
Yes,
to this
I
committee?
Was trying to get a copy of it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
The last two folks include the chief of the Dallas police, that's Jim Harper, Chief Harper, and Mr. Bob Russell. And Chief Harper, I apologize for overlooking you before. You were signed up earlier.
No problem. Okay.
Thank you for your patience.
Chair Gordley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Harper. I'm the police chief of Dallas Police Department, and I'm also the current president of the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police. So I'm here representing the chiefs of police in regard to the support for the Oregon State Police and their budget. The Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police represents over 140 local police departments throughout the state. But one of the things I want to talk about is the partnership that we have with the Oregon State Police. It's been an historical partnership. It's been one that we've testified to. We've been there in the past to support their budget. I was here testifying in the past for 100 troopers. I was here to testify in the past for forensics when the reductions were there. And to be honest with you, I'll be there in the future. And I can say that because of the relationship that the Oregon State Police has with local agencies. From a personal standpoint, from Dallas Police Department standpoint, I've had several incidences where the Oregon State Police have personally stepped up to the plate and dealt with extremely sensitive investigations. One of them was an environmental situation, officer-involved shootings. We had a situation where a little guy was kidnapped out of a city park in Dallas. He was subsequently dropped off near death in Marion County, and because of forensics and DNA, the suspect was apprehended and charged and convicted. Around every corner, the Oregon State Police has been there for us. They're like the pillars of the system, and I know you've heard that over and over again. But that's just our reality, and I just kind of feel sorry that we keep having to go over this session after session, and I know that we spend a lot of time talking about these same issues again and again. But from the police chief standpoint, They've been there for us, and they make the system work, and they make it come together. And especially with small agencies where you don't have a lot of resources, from criminal situations to forensics, we can't survive without them. And I'd be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Association. And I'm here to testify in support of OSP, but not necessarily in support of their budget. And I will explain that in a moment. Last session, we worked closely with this subcommittee to move a substantial amount of federal funds from the Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program, otherwise known as MCSAP, to the state police to increase their level of enforcement with trucking companies and truck drivers. Last year was the first full year of this new program, and OSP conducted over 18,000 inspections of trucks. Now, these are real important because in Oregon, as nationally, about 94% of the truck-at-fault accidents are caused by the action of the driver. Only about 6% are caused because of the mechanical failure of the truck or whatever. When OSP does an inspection, it's really two parts. They're stopping a truck driver on the highway that is doing something wrong. They have a probable cause stop. So that guy's doing something or gal that they shouldn't be doing. And secondly, when they do their inspections, they do not concentrate on the mechanical condition of the truck. They, in fact, concentrate on the driver to make sure his logbook is up to date, that he's not out of hours, he's not too tired to drive, he's got his medical card, and his CDL is current, he's got the endorsements that he needs to be transporting the cargo that he is. This program has demonstrated results, and I think you just hand out a comparison of truck accidents for 2003 and 2004. I'm recognizing 2004 was the first full year of the new program. Total crashes were down 7.63%. Truck at fault driver was down 10.56%. Fatality truck driver at fault, they were down 31.25%. So we're very proud of safety that in the trucking industry. And through the efforts of OSP, we're improving that, improving that significantly. The second program that we're very involved with OSP with is called Highway Watch, where OSP trains our truck drivers to be their eyes and ears out on the highway. And then the drivers, when they see something suspicious or they're in the event of an accident or something, they call right into OSP dispatch. And they're able to get help in those situations much quicker. That's been a very, very successful program. Matter of fact, the day that we kicked it off, there was a driver that unfortunately had a heart attack on I-5, and his car went off to the side of the road, and the Highway Watch driver called OSP, and they got there in time to save the man's life. So we work very closely in partnership with OSP. We're very, very supportive of what they do. And the reason that I said that I was here to support the agency but not necessarily their budget is because I don't believe you're going to be able to give them enough money. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 5057, the Oregon State Police budget? Is the superintendent still with us? I'm wondering if he wanted to comment on anything he heard. I want to give him that opportunity. Superintendent Ricker, I wanted to give you the opportunity to comment on any of the public testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I didn't hear it all. I stepped out to attend to my voice and other issues, but I certainly understood loud and clear the message from the parties testifying on behalf of the interests of the tribes. I understand their concern. I'm certainly willing to engage in a discussion about what those concerns are. I'm generally aware of the nature of the concern in the past, and my staff in the Gaming Enforcement Division have been reviewing, and in fact we have fewer people assigned to some of those assignments than we had in the past, but I'm not in a position to get into a detailed discussion at this point about it, but to the extent that the committee would like to have more information or have us respond in some way, we'd be happy to do that after the fact.
That would be very good. That would be the desire of the chair.
Yes, ma'am. We'd be happy to do that. With respect to the rest of the testimony that I heard, I certainly I think the committee. My reaction is, I think some of the people I knew were going to testify, some I did not. I think that there is both a urban and a rural relationship between the state police and our partners that sometimes doesn't get talked about as much as it might. There are some who believe that we should move the resources of the state police out to rural Oregon and not focus so much on the more populated areas. I certainly don't think that is a good way to proceed. We, as I said at the outset of this budget hearing, we have a very strong and vital relationship with the City of Portland Police Bureau and other metropolitan area law enforcement agencies. You heard the DA here in Marion County. It's all about partnership. Certainly the partnership is different in different parts of the state, but it is the state of Oregon, and we have, while the roles are various, we have a role everywhere in the state of Oregon, and I just thank the committee for your indulgence with sometimes some of the detail of our testimony or our presentation. And I also want you to know that I guess one of the reactions I had, and had wished I'd said this in my closing testimony, but did not. And sometimes we fall into the habit of talking about what we can't do because of resources that we wish we had or that we used to have. And the fact is, we need to spend more time talking about what we can do and what we do on a daily basis. And I said at the close of my testimony, and I meant it, that I think that the men and women of our organization, in partnership with lots of others from lots of other organizations in the state, are doing one heck of a job. And we are doing an awful lot of good things that do make a difference in the state of Oregon, including in traffic patrol and including in drug enforcement and including in criminal investigations and fish and wildlife enforcement. There's a lot more that's right about the Department of State Police than there is that's wrong with it. And I don't want that message to get lost in all this discussion about, especially those of us who have been around long enough to remember when it was different. We remember how even more vital we were as an organization and even more effective that we were. And for some of us, it makes it tough not to think about that. Maybe we shouldn't quit thinking about it because we would like to get back to a place where we can do an even better job, but we're doing one heck of a job right now. And we certainly appreciate the time that we've had with the committee.
We do appreciate that you all are doing a great job with what you have to work with. But with that said, the funding that the state provides, that the legislature provides, is inadequate. And, I personally find that unacceptable. And so that therein lies the challenge.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Superintendent.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 5057, Oregon State Police, and reopen a hearing on House Bill 5054, the Office of Homeland Security, and call forward Director Beverly Stilwell, Nancy Orr, and let's see what we can accomplish in the time remaining, which is about 15 minutes.
Madam Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, good afternoon. Previously, you've heard testimony from me to provide an agency overview, and you've also heard from one of the major divisions within the Office of Homeland Security, that being the Office of Emergency Management and Director Ken Murphy. Today, you will hear from Oregon State Fire Marshal Nancy Orr about the operations of the Office of the State Fire Marshal.
Madam Chair Gordley, members of the committee, this testimony starts on page 71 of your Phase 2 book under the State Fire Marshal tab. We build our programs at the Office of State Fire Marshal to execute our mission, which is to protect citizens, their property, and the environment from fire and hazardous materials. Our programs are community-based, and our primary partners are the volunteer and career personnel in the state's 330 municipal fire departments and rural fire districts. Partnering is one of our key service development and delivery strategies. We collaborate with a wide variety of public and private organizations, including construction trades and design professionals, managers of facilities who use and store hazardous materials and chemicals, service and nonprofit organizations, and local and state law enforcement, and county law enforcement, school administrators, and many others. We've also developed close working relationships with state and federal government agencies to coordinate and improve our services, and most significant of that are the Building Code Division, State Police Arson Unit, Oregon Youth Authority, Departments of Forestry, Public Safety Standards and Training, and Human Services and Environmental Quality. Staff time is our single largest resource, and the second of our key strategies is workforce development. The success of our efforts to meet our mission relies upon our employees and their technical knowledge, problem-solving skills, and their ability to communicate, their ability to work as a team with each other and others. One result of having a high level of employee expertise is that we rarely need to use professional services. Each program area has also developed long-term strategies and biennial business plans to invest their allocated revenues and to produce measurable outcomes. This is driven by our third strategy, which is to provide outcome-based customer service. The state fire programs, state fire marshal fire programs, provide prevention services and products directly to communities and indirectly through the local fire service, school, districts, and other collaborators. We use state and national fire trend data to target specific fire problems and audiences. The program services in the fire section include fire code and administration. We adopt a state fire code, enforcement and interpretation of that fire code, fire safety education and juvenile fire center intervention, fire cause investigation, fire data collection and analysis, and reducing fire risk and losses in urban wildland interface areas.
Let me ask a question here. You indicated that one of your partners is the Oregon Youth Authority. What is that relationship?
Chair Gordley, we work with Oregon Youth Authority to deliver firefighter intervention curriculum. Their counselors have been actively involved with a subcommittee that we have, task force, I guess you would call it, developing curriculum that are used by juvenile departments as well as at the OYA facilities. A very active partnership there.
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah. As we talked about yesterday, our funding source for the fire programs is a 1% premium tax. This revenue source was stabilized, as you're aware, last session. We're very grateful for the legislative action taken last session to stabilize that funding for us, the arson detectives and OSP, and fire training and certification at DPSST. One good thing, though, about revenue shortfalls is finding more ways to provide services at less cost. And the single largest cost savings that we have found in the last couple biennia has been distributing most of our documents and reports electronically rather than printing and mailing those. We're also transmitting our fire code inspection and field staff activity reports electronically. We're using conference calling to connect our field staff with meetings in Salem. And we're providing most of the frequently requested information on our website for folks to download. We also provide a lot of information on CDs. We also have developed and have distributed for free software for fire departments to report their fire incidents electronically rather than in hard copy, and this has significantly reduced staff time for fire departments and for us. This time has allowed us to provide more fire analysis services for the fire service and others. And we also now have a backup, electronic backup for fire departments, and we frequently get requests from fire departments who've lost their data, and we provide their backup for them since they've already submitted that to us. And they're also using this software to produce reports that document their fire protection deployment standard performance. That's unique to Oregon's fire reporting software. Our program goals and performance measure focus on our efforts to reduce fires and fire losses, especially in homes. And one strategy is teaching and mentoring local fire marshals to reduce fire risks in schools, assembly buildings, and manufacturing facilities by increasing the number of fire code inspections. And that performance measure for that indicator went up dramatically last year. After years of declines in fire deaths, we've seen a rising trend in the last few years. We're beginning to address that with intense home fire safety campaigns in partnership with local fire departments, insurance companies, and others. And the first of those campaigns kicked off at the Capitol here last week. It's fire safety. Home fire safety is up to you. I hope that you stopped by down there in the Galleria and got your free smoke alarm from Insurance Information Services of Oregon, Idaho. They're a primary partner with us in our home fire safety campaigns.
I'd like you to know that I passed on the smoke alarm to someone who did not have one in their home.
Thank you very much. That's exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to work hard. We're working hard to increase the number of working smoke alarms in homes nationally, and we feel that this data is probably true for Oregon. 96% of all households have smoke alarms installed. However, 36% of all fire fatalities occur in homes without smoke alarms. So we're working very hard to reach these high-risk residences, and with a U.S. Fire Administration grant, we developed and field-tested this biennium, a model program to go door-to-door and test and install smoke alarms in high-risk neighborhoods. For this, those materials have just come back from the printer, and we have a partnership with the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association to aggressively implement that model program next biennium.
Is there an urban-rural dimension to this problem? The 36% of fatal home fires. Where is this happening?
Statistically, more fires and more fire fatalities occur in older homes and in low-income neighborhoods, and those are the areas that we're targeting with our smoke alarm installations. We also are working to reduce the interface fire risks and losses and reduce the number of conflagration fires that we have. We reassigned a program coordinator to work specifically with local and county governments and our state and federal wildland agency partners to strategically reduce fuels and protect structures from wildland fires. All counties in Oregon currently have or they're actively developing a community wildland fire protection plan. This is being forwarded by the U.S. Forest Service under the National Fire Plan, as well as Oregon Department of Forestry with their Senate Bill 360 efforts. We're also making significant changes this biennium in how we administer the fire code in order to provide consistent and competent code enforcement and to raise the reliability and value of fire protection system plan review. This is as a result of some complaints on parts of the trades in our state that as they go from community to community, they get different stories from local fire marshals. So we have dramatically reduced the number of local adoptions of the state fire code dramatic reduction in amendments to the state fire code. My favorite example is with 12th Valley Fire and Rescue, where they reduced the number of amendments to the state fire code from 75 to 3. And we've seen similar kinds of reductions in other communities as well. We've also established, at the request of the trades, a one-call procedure for them to call to get an interpretation on a code question and get a quick turnaround so we don't hold up final occupancy of buildings that are being constructed. The Portland Metro Fire Departments have been working together to develop one standard guidebook for fire apparatus and other discretionary regulations, things that are the discretionary of the local fire chief, and we're finding other counties are rapidly adopting those standards as well. We almost can't keep up with it, which is a good thing. We're also improving our competence and consistency. We've established some knowledge and performance standards for local fire marshals. We're raising the certification requirements for state and local fire departments to provide plan review input to building officials. As Chief Johnson noted, a major component of what we do is emergency response coordination. When the governor declares a conflagration fire, our office coordinates the response from the structural fire departments. Employees from all of our programs staff our emergency communication center that's at the Four Seas Ambulance Readiness Center, where you toured recently. And we also coordinate three Type 2 incident management teams. Those teams include an information officer, and that is often the face of the state fire marshal or state government at wildfire interface incidents. As we discussed yesterday, that those incidents or those incident command teams integrate with the federal or ODF incident management team that is there, and they also coordinate their information with our information officer here in Salem. One of our public education staff serves a dual role as information officer, and she has been working with the information officers in other state agencies to discuss how the state of Oregon is going to comply with the National Incident Management System requirement for joint information centers when there are large-scale disasters. And as you're well aware, we're having more and more conflagrations for a number of reasons, and the cost of those directly impacts our state general fund. That's one of the reasons that we have targeted it to as something we need to work on preventing. As the chief said, also we have a growing capacity for urban search and rescue. This is a response to the events of September 11th, 2001. And we've been working since then to build an intermediate, what's called a Type 2 structural collapse rescue and recovery capacity for Oregon communities. If we had a huge structural collapse incident from earthquake or a human-caused disaster, that would quickly outstrip the resources of any of our communities here in Oregon. It also takes 24 to 36 hours for a Type 1 federal team to respond. Chief Seidel mentioned his participation in a Type 1 incident management team that responded to New York. It takes them 24 to 36 hours to get mobilized and on the ground, and as you're aware, those are the most critical hours if you're going to find trapped victims for survival. So through some homeland security grants, the state of Oregon now has three equipment caches, a significant amount of equipment, specialized equipment. It's equivalent to a Type 1 teams. And we have 204 firefighters who are trained to rescue technician level. And we have a new $330-some thousand grant to do additional training with these resources so that they have the training they need in the specialty positions on a task force. We're just getting closer and closer to readiness here in Oregon.
Excellent. I think this would be a good place for us to stop for
all
today.
Right.
And we will pick up with the urban search and rescue piece of the discussion the next time we meet.
Thank you very much, Chair
Thank
Gordon.
You. Thank you very much. And the record should also show, and I neglected to announce this at the beginning of the meeting, that both Representative Hannah
and Representative Hansen were excused to attend funerals today. And Senator Devlin is on legislative business, and Senator Winters continues to be excused. And we are adjourned. Thank you.